Good evening. Welcome to The Big Fight. Tonight, a two-parter, a discussion and a debate. Our lead discussion, COVID-19, the hunt for a cure, and why some experts feel the actual number of cases in India is many, many times more than what is now being reported. The central focus is this, as we get set for the first day of what some say is a trial lockdown this Sunday, can we truly delay the spread of this infection to a larger community? This will be the difference in potentially saving thousands of lives. Remember, if this becomes a community-wide transmission, we may never be able to locate and isolate the source of the infection. And at half past the hour, the Kamal Nath government in Madhya Pradesh has collapsed. He's resigned before a vote in the state assembly. Our question, power-hungry Maharaja, in other words, Jyotiraditya Sindhya, or is the Congress responsible for its loss in Madhya Pradesh? Well, we've got a wonderful panel today to look at the COVID situation. I'm going to introduce them. We are joined by Adar Poonawalla, the CEO of the Serum Institute of India, somebody who's been leading the fight to try and find a cure for the coronavirus. We're also joined by Ramanan Lakshmi Narayan, affiliate professor of global health at the Center for Disease Dynamics, somebody who's written extensively about this issue as well. And we'll be joined by other panelists soon too. But first, let me go across to Adar Poonawalla. Adar, the work done by the Serum Institute represents some of the most promising, but also some of the most challenging efforts at trying to find a cure. The one question that everybody would want to know from you: how soon? What's your answer?
Well, I think we need to manage everyone's expectations. People are naturally expecting a cure to come out fast. Traditionally, a vaccine takes 6 to 7 years to develop. But due to the efforts put in by the global regulatory bodies in the US and in India, we should be able to get a vaccine out within 2 years. We, at the moment, are going through animal studies in mice and primates in the United States as we speak. And hopefully in 2 months, we'll have a good candidate to go into human trials. And then maybe a year after that to prove that a vaccine actually is safe and efficacious both.
And the cost of this vaccine would be competitive. This wouldn't be a situation like HIV in the early days when there were cures which were coming about, but medication which was so expensive that it was outpriced. This would not be the situation in this case.
No, certainly not. I think if SII is able to produce this vaccine for about $7 to $10 or even less once the volumes ramp up, it's going to be a very ethically priced product as long as it's coming out from an Indian vaccine manufacturer. I can't comment on what, you know, the French and the United States companies will be able to price it at. Their vaccines are traditionally sold at $50, $100 also. But I'm sure they'll also make an exception for COVID-19 being a global epidemic and make it affordable.
And where is the science in terms of the vaccine right now?
I think we're all experimenting at the moment. No one really has anything in hand. It would be incorrect to say, you know, you can cure it with a candidate that is already proven, or the malaria drugs or anything else for that matter. Until we get a proper randomized human clinical double-blinded study done in the United States, in India, or any other place, it's too soon to say that anything is working out to be effective. And let me also add that any vaccine or cure that does come out in the treatment or as a preventive will always be 70 to 80% effective. There's always a chance that 20% will not. And that's the main issue here. We need to make peace with the fact that this virus is here to stay now on our planet. We need to go about our everyday lives, of course, with caution and mitigation that the government has very nicely done and acted in a very decisive manner. But we have to keep essential goods and services production on, and quick, rapid testing happening with quarantine measures to take care of those who show symptoms. That's all we can do. It's all about mitigation. We can't stop the livelihoods now in the hope and the wake that a vaccine or a cure will be there to, you know, save us all from this terrible epidemic.
Yeah. Adar, tell us a little bit about the technology which you have in place now to speedily develop a vaccine. I understand what you mentioned earlier on about tests and the fact that that's going to take time. There is regulation across governments. That's going to take time. But just in terms of the technology in place to work towards having something which you believe should work, how is that absolutely cutting edge?
Well, there's two technologies. One is with a joint venture with Themis in the United States and Pasteur Institute in Paris. These, together with the SII, are developing a protein that will be adapted onto the measles Schwann strain. Mm-hmm. And that should be a fairly safe live attenuated vaccine candidate that we're looking at developing. It's also one of the vaccine candidates shortlisted by CEPI. You know that they're funding a lot of these new vaccine development programs. And the other one with Codagenix is a genetically modified strain which will remove the harmful properties from the live strain and then therefore be a vaccine which is now being tested in animals as we speak. And that's, of course, far ahead because it's already into mice and primates. And in 2 months, when you ask me, what the status is, I can give you an accurate answer without just, making promises of what might work or not. So I think that'll be a more responsible way of responding in 2 months' time.
It's also fairly incredible, isn't it, that the people you have working in this are some of the finest minds, some of the finest scientists, researchers, geneticists involved in this project. It must feel incredible to be part of a process now where perhaps more than ever we need people like you to come out with a solution. It's as simple as that. The onus is on you. It's a monstrous burden. Tell us about the team that works with you. And, the sense of pressure, because at one level there must be pressure on you because we are all counting on this to work.
No, of course, there's a tremendous moral pressure. And, we've got a team built over the last three, four decades, which has tremendous large-scale vaccine production experience. We're producing 1.5 billion doses a year of various vaccines. And we're counting on the scientists here and also the innovators in the United States who are doing most of the innovation there. But then scaling up something, going through the regulatory process and manufacturing it is a whole different story. So after all these guys, whoever they may be, including the ones we've partnered with, when they come out with a vaccine candidate, which is proven in human trials, you'll need companies, a lot of Indian vaccine companies to step up, such as ours, to be able to produce this on a large scale, because naturally the whole world is going to need this in tremendous volumes in a very short span of time. And that's where we really come into our contribution.
And one final question, what would you hope for from the government of India to push things through faster? Should you go to the government and say, look, I think I've got something which works?
I think what we're doing is waiting for 2 months to present our animal data to the health ministry. We can see how they respond. But right now, all the signs have been very favorable. They've already made committees and other task forces to rapidly speed up regulatory approvals. And so that'll be very helpful. And we're very grateful for them to have taken that step over the last 1 month in light of what's happening. So we look forward to that.
All right, Adar Poonawalla, thank you very much for joining us today, and we really hope things do work out. So many lives will depend on this. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, we are joined now by Ramanan Lakshminarayan, Affiliate Professor of Global Health at the Center for Disease Dynamics. A lot of his research and his studies have really gone viral around the world, his messaging to the BBC on what this presents itself potentially in the case of India is something that we really need to understand and appreciate. One of the leading researchers in this entire COVID-19 situation, and what he says comes on the basis of solid work, which is why it's important we listen to what he says. Before I go across to Professor Lakshminarayanan, let me just bring out this one particular graphic. This is the situation with China presently. This is data from Johns Hopkins and the situation with other locations. Now, there is a lot of hope, actually, in this particular graphic, because as you can see, as far as mainland China is concerned, the infection rate has plateaued out. The infection rate has plateaued out. That means that if you are good in your fight against COVID-19, if you do ensure social distancing, if you do ensure that lockdowns take place, should they be required, and if you do have an idea of the actual number of cases as opposed to just data-based cases that you are generating, then you could be on the way to winning the fight. Compare that with other locations. As you can see, that has gone right up. No sign whatsoever of plateauing. And even if you were to look at the situation of India, we are now spiking upwards, nowhere close to that plateau stage. Professor Lakshmi Narayanan, the real numbers in India, 4 deaths, perhaps 5 deaths. What is your sense? Are these accurate numbers?
So the number of deaths is based on actually testing people for COVID. And we don't test many people. Our testing standard is basically that we test people who come off a plane or people who have known contact with a confirmed case. That's a very narrow testing standard. So if you got COVID in the community, no one is going to test you for coronavirus right now. And because of that, we are seriously probably undercounting cases. At this stage in the epidemic, we probably have had community transmission for a few weeks now, probably 2 or 3 weeks. And keep in mind, we don't count deaths in our country because we don't have a good death tracking system. So someone died in a hospital with respiratory symptoms who also had diabetes or also had some cardiovascular conditions, we would never know about it. And that's really the situation we're in right now. But very soon that day will arrive when the numbers are just cannot be avoided because they start going up so much that it becomes, you know, socially noticeable, and that's what we're up against.
Based on the data generated by Wuhan, what numbers could there potentially be out in India at this stage in terms of true numbers?
Okay, so this virus, although it's novel, it behaves like a flu virus with respect to transmission, very much like a flu virus. And it generates roughly 2.3 cases for every individual is infected. So every infected individual is generating another 2 to 3 secondary infections, which is what causes that exponential growth. Given our estimates today, we probably think that the number of actual cases in the tens of thousands, but remember, most of them are mild infections. So people won't even know that they had, coronavirus, that they had COVID. But a small proportion, maybe about 6,000 to 8,000, probably have severe disease, and they're around the country. But our surveillance system is not able to track 7,000 people with severe disease in a country of almost 1.4 billion. So we have challenges.
Tens of thousands right now. If we don't isolate in a much more effective way, by which I mean a proper lockdown in identified cities, then where can we be in terms of these numbers?
So in terms of these numbers, unless we completely shut down, which I personally think is impossible for India, given our population and people have to work every day and so forth, we're headed to a total of about 300 to 500 million cases by July. Now, that sounds like a lot, and I want to reassure your viewers, most of those cases are going to be mild. You won't even know anything worse than, small fever or respiratory symptoms or whatever. It's only a small proportion of these that will be severe. And the population at risk is really the elderly. So really, all the social distancing we are doing is not for ourselves at our age. This is a battle to save the elderly. And that's really what this is about.
And again, neither your goal nor my goal as a presenter is to scare people. But no. if we don't socially distance more effectively, then in terms of the number of fatalities, and I take your point completely that the elder, those who are older are more susceptible, those with other ailments simultaneously are more susceptible, what numbers could we look at?
We would probably be looking at something in the range of about 10 million severe infections over that period of time, which goes from about 4 weeks from now to about 12 weeks from now. And that number of severe infections, some of them would translate into deaths, quite a few, in fact. It could go up to as many as 1 million or 2 million deaths. And if you think that's large, those are projections which are conservative, even by, say, U.S. estimates or other estimates. Possibly the arrival of the summer will help us a little bit based on the new data that are emerging. We can't bank on it, but I think it may help us somewhat, particularly in the south of India. But just to give your viewers, again, some context here, in India, there are 8 million deaths every year. So if you add another 1 million or 1.5 million, you might say, okay, that's only a 10 or 15% increase in deaths. For us as a society, we're going to have to deal with that very large number of deaths in a very short period of time. That's what would be very difficult for us, and we need to prepare for that, that this is going to happen. And to some extent, even with the most amount of social distancing, we're headed down this path. So this is just the way in which this virus works.
I just want to bring up this graphic on population density, China versus India, and then get your comments on that, because I think that's key, absolutely, in where India potentially stands. Let's bring that graphic, the second graphic, up if we can. All right, well, this graphic actually shows the number of people in China. If we can just get that graphic up. Right, we've got these numbers over here. In India, it's a little more than 440 people per square kilometer in India. And in China, that number is significantly less. In China, it's 148.81 people per square kilometer. So obviously, the density over here in India is considerably more than what it is in China, 2.96 times more dense than China. So Professor Lakshmi Narayanan, what does that mean for a situation in India, potentially, density of population?
So the density is a little misleading for the following reason, that most of China is unoccupied because of the desert, the Gobi Desert. So most people are living in the south, east and the northeast of China. Ours is a slightly more dispersed population, obviously, with the exception of Rajasthan, which is, you know, slightly more sparsely populated. But let me give you three reasons to be optimistic and three, or maybe a couple, to be pessimistic. The optimistic thing is, compared to China, we have a younger population. So that builds up more of a herd immunity in the younger people. We're protecting the elderly that way. And we also have fewer elderly, which is a good thing. Second is, as I said, there's a seasonality to this. But keep in mind that this is not a one-shot game. Whatever we face now in the next 3 months is not over yet. It will come back to us in November and December. So whoever's not experienced an infection at that point in time, and if they're elderly, they're at risk at that point in time, because as you just heard, we're not going to have a vaccine in that particular, in that time frame.
So two quick questions. Yeah. Two quick questions. Number one, the new data that you're talking about the impact of temperatures on this, the WHO a few weeks back had said that there isn't enough data to say that the hotter it gets, it's going to get better. Are you suggesting that there is something which is different now, which gives us hope? And my second question to you, if you have this infection, can you get it again?
So if you get the infection, if it's the same, you're going to get it again. Although, you know, there's been a couple of instances when people have gotten it again, but we don't know if they were completely recovered before they were tested. So we don't have full data on that. On temperature and humidity, I should say it's a combination of these. It's not just temperature, it's humidity as well. We don't have complete data, but remember, the data are just coming out of China, which we're seeing studies of. So again, not something we can count on, but it's something to hope for, in the same way that I said that our young population potentially helps us. But let me also give you the bad news. The bad news is that, similar to the Chinese, Indians smoke a lot. We have bad air quality and our lungs are not great. And since this is a respiratory infection, that potentially could be an issue here. The second is, we may not be able to extrapolate from the fact that kids in China didn't really have severe infections, because children in India, particularly in rural areas, are undernourished. So we don't know how well that translates into India as well. So some things that are very different about us, and some which are in a good way and some not so good way, I think we will find out.
All right. Well, Ramanan Lakshmi Narayanan, thank you for being so lucid in explaining all of this to us. I think that's so important, just the ability to communicate the situation as it stands now so that people can understand. Thanks very much for joining us. We're also joined now by three experts: Ranu Bhogal, Director of the Policy of Research and Campaigns at Oxfam; Arvind Kumar, one of India's leading doctors, Chairman of the Center for Chest Surgery at Gangaram; and Dr. Swapnil Parikh, who is a leading expert and who also joins us as far as this is concerned. Let me go across to Dr. Arvind Kumar first. Dr. Kumar, in the past, we've been speaking about the importance to lockdown, the importance of social distancing. What do you make of what's been announced by the Prime Minister now in terms of that Sunday, one-day lockdown? In fact, let me put that across to Dr. Swapnil Parikh first. What do you make of that one-day lockdown on Sunday? Do you believe it's a good start?
Namaste.
Namaskar.
Thank you for having me here. I do believe it's a good start. This is because in India, we don't have a lot of experience with pandemic response. So using a strategy such as this allows people to kind of get used to the idea of a lockdown. It also gives the government crucial data on whether the populace will cooperate or not. Because if the populace doesn't cooperate for even 12 hours, then we know we have a real serious problem. So we have to think of it as something, A, to sensitize people, but also to give us data as to whether people will appeal, people will listen to the government's appeals or not. I would just like to clarify one thing. You know, earlier you said that we shouldn't try to scare anyone on the media. But here's the important thing. If we do scare people, we shouldn't scare them out of their wits. We should scare them into their wits. People do need some fear because this is a very, very serious situation in front of us. And fear can be a powerful motivator if it doesn't induce panic. You have to act on it correctly.
Okay. Let me go across to Dr. Arvind Kumar. Dr. Kumar, can you hear me, sir?
Yeah, I can hear you.
So, Dr. Kumar, for the last several days, you know, we've had you on our shows and we've spoken about the need for testing and more testing. So two aspects of my question. Firstly, now that you've got the public sector more actively involved in testing, do you believe that we'll get an idea of the true numbers? And number two, as a first step, this move by the Prime Minister for this Janta quarantine on Sunday, what do you make of it?
Vishnu, your audio is gone again.
Can you hear me
now?
Hello? Can you hear me now?
But I missed out your last part of your question.
So just answer the first part of the question.
No, I just heard you say that we've been talking about increasing in numbers versus testing.
Yeah, so let me repeat my question then. Two parts of my question. The first part, do you believe now with the private sector's involvement, testing can actually take place at a good level? And secondly, what do you make of the Sunday move for quarantining announced by the Prime Minister?
So private sector being involved and more testing being done is good, because I have always suspected from day one that the numbers which are being declared and announced are just the tip of the iceberg. And I have said it 2 days back also on your show that the real numbers are many, many, many times more. And there is infection which is simmering in the community and it's there waiting to explode any day. And I must share with you that I just read half an hour back that today about 30 people have tested positive in NIV Pune. Now, this is something I read on the internet. I do not know whether it is correct or not. But if it's correct, it's a very, very serious matter. I have also read about somebody in AIIMS Bhopal who is a positive case, having come in contact with a large number of doctors, about which the Resident Doctors Association have complained. Now, Vishnu, these are clear-cut indicators of what is happening at the community level. If anyone today says that this is still in stage two, we have not yet hit stage three, I think he is just closing his eyes to the reality which is glaring at us. The reality is that there is, I think we've already moved from two to stage three, and it's just a matter of few days before this bomb explodes in front of our eyes.
Doctor, when you say when this bomb explodes in front of our eyes, what is it that we will see? Will we see a sharp spike in cases, or will we see a sharp spike in death rates?
Vishnu, if you track the numbers that are increasing for the last 10 days, first we had few cases, no death. Then we had 5 to 6 per day increase in the number of cases. And then we had little more increase in the number of cases. And if you look at the number of cases added in the last 24 hours, it's the largest number added in the last 2 weeks. Yesterday, the number was around 156 or 160. I'm talking of the reported cases. And today, we are touching 250. So roughly 70, 80 declared cases added in the last 24 hours, which is the largest increase. So not only are the numbers increasing, but the increase in the numbers of numbers is also increasing. And this just is reflective of a large volume of cases which are there out there in the society. And I guess by Wednesday or Thursday or latest by the next weekend, this bomb will explode in front of us. And when it happens, when you have a large number of people falling sick, as has been said. Now look at that graphic.
Yep.
The largest increase in the number of cases has been today. This
yes.
could be more tomorrow. This could be still more day after tomorrow. And I don't think we need artificial intelligence to figure out where this this graph will ultimately lead to. So we are just a few days away from a very, very serious, maybe Spain or Italy or China-like situation. And when we have a large number of cases infected, of course, majority of them will be mild, but given our population density, given that a large number of people in our country suffer from undernutrition, various lung ailments, diabetes is so common in our country, heart disease is so common, and the kind of health resources, health infrastructure we have at the periphery. I don't think, again, we need artificial intelligence to be able to figure out that these large number of cases will also convert into a large number of deaths, which is now not too far away for us to be seeing. The writing is there on the wall. If we still want to close our eyes, the choice is ours.
Dr. Kumar, have you conveyed your very strong views, which is something which a lot of people have said, to the health ministry, to the health minister, to those monitoring our situation? What do they say?
Vishnu, I spoke exactly the same words on your show day before yesterday night. I have been conveying this to every channel who's coming to me. Please, overreaction is better than underreaction. If we overreact today and prevent an Italy-like situation, it is better than underreacting today and overreacting when it is already too late. In a situation like this, overreaction is the only correct reaction.
Okay, so therefore, this trial lockdown, if I can use those words, which the Prime Minister announced on Sunday, because he also said that this will prepare us for future challenges. Do you believe that that is too little, that we should be in lockdown right now?
Vishnu, I appreciate Honorable Prime Minister for the way he conveyed these things to the country. But I think a lot of changes have happened between yesterday evening and today evening. The way the number of cases have started increasing, see the delta between the previous 24 hours and the last 24 hours, there is a sharp rise. This is reflective of the explosion which is about to come. So I agree that this Janta curfew is a wonderful step, but I think this Janta curfew should be started by Janta from tonight, not from Sunday morning, one, and it should be at least for the next 2 weeks, leaving aside bare minimum essential services like health services or, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 essential services which are mandatory for letting the country run. There should be 100% lockdown. And I'll tell you why. If you look at the transmission, it spreads by direct droplet to droplet transmission. Now, I went to one of the big government complexes, CGO complex today. The entire CGO complex was working. Now, there are thousands of employees who come. They start from their houses, they travel through the city. Imagine if few percentage of them are positive. On the way, they have infected so many other people and they have contracted infection from so many people. Total distancing of people, confinement within our houses, and breaking this direct person-to-person droplet transmission is the only way. The second way, whatever transmission happens through the hand, hand hygiene is the method. Okay. So stop droplet-to-droplet direct transmission and also hand transmission. So complete lockdown is the crying need of the hour.
All right, Doctor, thank you so much for sharing those perspectives with us. I want to go across to Ranu Bhogal at this stage. Ranu, it's very difficult in our country to have a lockdown. It's almost inconceivable. Absolutely. It's not beyond China.
Yeah.
It's difficult to make this happen. What are some of the big social challenges that we face in the days ahead?
A huge social challenge, Soam, is that 90%, more than 90% of the economically active population in this country is in the unorganized sector. They are daily wage earners, and a complete lockdown. I myself, my organization, we are all working from home for the past week. We have extended it for another week. But it's absolutely impossible to imagine these daily wage earners who sit in their homes for next 2 weeks. And I really appreciate what the Chief Minister of Kerala has done in responding to actually making food available at doorstep, the midday meal available, dry rations. And I think that is what is required. And the other thing for this hand hygiene, to wash hands, we know the condition of water access in most of these densely populated slums of our country. There is very, very little water, clean drinking water, even available for drinking. So if we are expecting, and I completely agree with the doctor, that hand hygiene, washing hands is so critical to stop the transmission of this disease, I think we'll need to have a response on a humanitarian response, you know, as if there's a flood or an earthquake. You know, it's that kind of an emergency situation. We'll have to make water available. We'll have to make toilets available. Their community toilets need to be kept clean. These are shared services. And I think that's the kind of response. Maybe some kind of cash transfers are required. After all, this government did transfer money to farmers before the elections this year. They must ensure that there are Jan Dhan accounts. Please transfer money so that daily wage earners can buy their basic minimum necessities.
Absolutely.
I think the points that you mentioned,
and there's so many of them, are so important, and we really need to keep following up on these points. But I really do need to wrap this part of my program up, but we will continue tracking this as we have been every single day.